This is Ben Settle of BenSettle.com. I'm talking to Brian Kurtz, Executive Vice President of Boardroom, which is a nine-figure per year book and newsletter publisher. Brian is named Marketer of the Year by Target Marketing Magazine. He's been at this for 35 years, has seen, I would assume, millions of dollars in split tests. He's worked with all the top A-list copywriters like Gary Bensavenga, Doug Deanna, and even the late, great Gene Schwartz, all the best of the best. He's putting together a historic marketing seminar this year where he's basically like what I would consider Nick Fury assembling the Avengers, all the marketing superheroes and the direct marketing world under one roof. And from what I hear, he's the best in the world at picking the winner in A-B split tests after he knows the results. So, Brian, I got to tell you, man, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. This is a very cool opportunity. Thank you so much for doing this.
And vice versa, Ben. Of all the people that I follow, this is so much stuff that comes into my inbox from various copywriters and direct marketers and creatives. Your stuff is about as good as it gets. And not only that, when I went out to people and I said, and this isn't just about talking about the Titans event, I really did want to deliver some content for you first and foremost. But I said to people, if I was going to go out and talk to somebody about the Titans event, who would really be able to talk with me about copy at the deepest level without me being a copywriter, who would it be? And your name comes up every single time. So feel good about that.
I do. I had no idea. I'm kind of a hermit, but.
Yeah, you and Ray Edwards are like similar like that. I think Ray's name comes up a lot, too, and it's like he calls himself a hermit. And I'm like, these guys are some of the smartest marketers I've ever known, and I don't get to meet them because they're hermits, which is kind of sucks.
Oh, well, maybe sometime. I'm gonna ask you some questions that my list has submitted. Some very good questions they've asked. I'm going to ask some of mine first, though.
Okay.
Maybe a little greedy here.
Good.
But first, can you tell us about how you got into this industry and what it was like and some success principles that you've learned during your years, especially working alongside Marty Edelstein? And just give us, some background just for anyone listening to this who isn't really familiar with Boardroom or you or anyone else like that.
Yeah. So, like a lot of people, I fell into it. I thought after college, I was an English major, so I perfectly suited. I always say to people I was voted in my high school yearbook most likely to become a list manager. But I out of college, I thought I was going to either be a baseball umpire, which I still umpire, or I was going to be a college professor of English, or I was going to be the next great film critic for the New York Times. And obviously, I didn't do any of those things. And so, but I found, and without going into the whole long story, I did end up at Boardroom, my second job. I was in the list side of the business. Started learning direct marketing, and I actually still thought I was going to be an editor or a writer at Boardroom when I got here. And I remember maybe a year or two into Boardroom, a job opened up at the on the editorial side. And I went to Marty and I said, "Hey, Marty, this job opened up. I think I'm ready to go to the editorial side." And Marty, in his infinite wisdom, said, "Brian, I've been watching you for the last 2 years. You have a real nose for marketing." I have a pretty big nose too, but he said, you have a real nose for marketing," was his quote. And you're 2 years out of college or 3 years out of college, and the owner of the company looks at you and says, he wants you to stay where you are, and I'm liking it. It wasn't like I was disliking my job at all. I just was, I think the lesson might be, you get on this track that you think, "Oh, of course I'm going to be an editor, right? Because I'm a writer." And, why would I even think about being on the marketing side? And the rest is sort of history in that respect as far as learning the direct marketing business from the list side. Boardroom sold mostly newsletters and books, started with a business newsletter called Boardroom Reports. Bottom Line Personal then became the lead newsletter, which is more of a consumer newsletter. And then we started doing a ton of health books and stuff. So it was a journey of the content changed, but the journey was very much learning direct marketing from the list side and the audience side, which was a great place to come from. And Marty, really took me under his wing very early on. I think he saw some of himself. He was more driven than I was, and probably, I didn't start this business. He did. So we know who the bootstrap entrepreneur was, and it wasn't me. It was him. But he saw something in me that was very entrepreneurial in terms of idea generation, and he made me a partner, not that long into my tenure into boardroom, you know, maybe 10 years in. And, you know, he was an amazing, amazing man in terms of not just spotting talent. I'll say that he spotted me, and maybe that was his exception, but he spotted a lot of other talent. But he really understood what it meant to be excellent. You know, really understood that mediocre just wasn't good enough. I always use the Henry Kissinger story when I describe Marty. You know, Henry Kissinger would send an aide to go write a speech, and they come back, and as soon as they come back, he goes, "That's not good enough. Go back and write it again." And, you know, after the eighth time, the guy comes back and says, "Mr. Kissinger, I wrote this thing eight times, you know, and I can't do any better. It's finally exactly the way I want it." And Kissinger's response was, "Okay, good, now I'll read it." And that's the way kind of Marty was. It wasn't like he was, you know, he wasn't a demand for the sake of being a demand, but he always knew that you could do better. I mean, he had something on his stationery that said, "Good, better, best, never let it rest until the good is better and the better best." And he really demanded excellence in everything. The other big lesson I got from Marty was, I love this quote of his. It was, "The only things worth talking about are the things you can't talk about." And that's not about figuring out what the gossip of the day is. What Marty was so great at, and what I've continued to be good at, not as great as him, is what I'll say calling the question. You know, they call it the old moose on the table. There's like a big issue that is confronting us, and it could be creative, it could be marketing, it could be anything, it could be personnel. And everybody sort of skirts the issue. And the image, of course, is you're sitting at a boardroom table, not our boardroom, any boardroom table, and there's a big rotting carcass of a moose, you know, across the entire table with the guts spilling out, and everybody's having a conversation looking around the dead moose, saying anything but the dead moose is on the table, you know, spilling its guts. And Marty would never be shy about, you know, calling out what we really needed to talk about, what was the most important thing. And I think that's why we ended up getting, you know, the best copy, the best, you know, the best copywriters to work for us, the best list selection. You know, he just, no compromise, just never a compromise. And, you know, there is an expression now that people say, you know, done is better than perfect. And Marty wasn't so great at that. You know, 80% done for him a lot of times wasn't good enough. I think in today's world with the internet, we tend to, you know, in some cases 60% good is good enough, since you can slap it out there, you think, and it's good enough to test. But I maintain that, you know, you spend a lot of time putting out crappy tests, even on the internet, there will be diminishing returns in the long run. So I think those were the like big, powerful 30,000-foot view lessons from Marty. There were so many little ones as far as, you know, how we talked about, how we thought about copy and how we thought about hiring copywriters. And I think we're going to talk about that later anyway. So maybe we'll get into more granular. But those are some of the bigger ones.
Okay. You know, when you mentioned that he was good at spotting talent, and I couldn't help but think of the guy who, what was his name, Mel Martin, the guy who created the Fascination.
Yes.
Wasn't he like the, like a secret copywriter for you guys?
Yeah, it's funny. I was on a call with Bob Bly, and the same question came up. And I'm going to do a blog about it because right after Mel died, or shortly after, Denny Hatch did an article, and it was something like the best copywriter you never heard of. And I was telling Bob Bly, and I'll tell you this too, which is really important, that Marty and I were great sharers. We would share everybody, everything. You know, we were very open with, you know, because to us, competition was coexistence. You know, there was no such thing about keeping a great list to ourselves. If Agora told us the best list they're mailing, and we told them the best list we're mailing, all boats rose. So it's weird because Marty had this reputation of keeping this writer, Mel Martin, under wraps, and like he wasn't going to share him with anybody. But it was actually the true story is that Mel and Marty went back to the days of when Marty was at Commentary Magazine, and before he started Boardroom, and he also was part of this Jewish book club, and he had Mel Martin write copy for him that was this, you know, the secrets of the Talmud, see page 47, you know, the Jewish encyclopedia or something. And so Mel had followed the work of Ralph Ginzburg in terms of, you know, using page numbers, using, you know, culling out these fascinations, And Marty and Mel were this incredible team. And Marty wasn't a copywriter, but Marty was not too shabby when it came to crafting words. And so the two of them were almost like writing stuff together. So when Boardroom was launched, and Gene Schwartz did write the first promotion for Boardroom Reports, but Mel was in the background. I think he had another job. And eventually Marty and Mel teamed up again, probably late 70s, early 80s, when Bottom Line Personal was launched. And Mel just wanted to work for Marty. Mel said, you know, I want to write copy for you. Let's work on this together. I'll help you launch Bottom Line Personal. I want to start doing some of these consumer books. I mean, all the stuff we learned at the Jewish Book Club. And interestingly, the reason why Marty kept Mel a secret was on Mel's request. Mel said, I don't want to work for anybody else. I don't want to be a copywriter for hire. I want to be your partner at Boardroom. He wasn't a full-time employee. He still had some freedom. But, you know, Mel wanted just to work for Marty. They were two peas in a pod. So the keeping Mel Martin under wraps and not sharing him with the industry was Mel's request more than it was Marty's. And Mel had no interest in kind of getting into the, I'll call it the rat race, of selling his wares as a copywriter. He just wanted to be Marty's guy. And Mel was a character. I mean, Mel used to – I had a cubicle next to him in 1981 in New York, and he used to come into the office totally scruffy, you know, unshaven. He wore like, you know, like usually always wore a white or beige suit with no tie, of course, in the middle of the winter, and he wore these white buck shoes, and he chain smoked. I mean, then you could smoke cigarettes in the office, and if he didn't have cigarettes, he couldn't write, which was so cool. He was like a throwback, you know, one of these. He could be in Mad Men, you know. He was just like chain smoking. He was, I don't think he was a drinker, but he was like a chain smoker. And he would just churn out the copy, just churn out the fascinations. And back then, Marty would write a lot of the bridge copy. And the other thing that I shared with Bob, and I'll share it with you in a different version, I think that what I've seen over the years is the evolution of fascination copy, where, you know, back then it was always about – you there?
Yeah, I'm always,
I just want to turn my phone off. It was always about sizzle, no steak. Like you only gave away the sizzle, and that's what the fascinations were about. It was always about, you know, making the prospect vibrate, you know, getting under the surface of things, but not giving away anything. And then as we progressed in our history of different formats, from number 10 envelopes to magalogs and bookalogs, you know, those formats lent themselves to telling a much longer story, even though we used 12-page letters even back in 1980. But I think the 12-page letter moving into the bookalog and magalog, it was so designed, and I think there was a question later on about design, which is really important, and it was so important to start giving away some of the steak. You know, the old thing, and Clayton Makepeace was one of the first that did this for us. You know, four secrets to lowering your blood pressure, you give away two, and then the other two are on page 63 of the premium. So the evolution of the fascination evolved to that through our formats. And of course, now you look at the internet, and it's like on steroids, right? You give away so much content for free first. Before you even sell anything, if you do it right, you know, product launch formula methodology. So I always found that interesting as I've watched the evolution of that. Like you know, and I was taught to never give away the steak, but I think copywriters on this call, and I think you'll agree, that there's a lot of opportunity to give away steak and do it intelligently and actually have a much better sell-through by doing it, you know, in a different way than we were taught back in the 1980s.
No, that's very interesting. I know with emails, I'm still a sizzle guy, but I'm able to, not just me, but a lot of people who understand how to do the emails certain ways can kind of make it look like steak, even though it's sizzle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they make it seem like I just gave away something, even though I didn't. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know what? That's just as good, Ben. You know, if you do that, then you've gotten the customer's attention. But, you know, however you get it done, that's what makes great copywriters. And I'm not one. You know, I have copywriter envy. I really do. I've had it my whole career. I know how special it is to be a great copywriter, and I value it at the highest level. And I think I was having a conversation with John Carlton the other day, who's one of my heroes and a good friend, and you know, just talk to Carlton for an hour, and it's like one like bit of wisdom after another. And John was making the point to me that he thinks the next big breakthroughs online are not going to necessarily be completely technological. Like, you know, not that we've gotten to everywhere we've gotten. There'll be a lot more technological, you know, whiz-bang stuff coming forward. But he thinks, and we got into this conversation about the game-changing isn't going to be the technology. I think it's going to come back to a lot of the storytelling and a lot of the copy. And I've already seen it, so I'm not like making believe. I'm not making this up. And it's so interesting when you look at the people talking about how important storytelling is in the internet space. It makes me sort of smile, you know, sort of like internet people saying that physical product is the new deep dark secret of internet marketing. You know, give away physical
yeah.
product on the back end for higher perceived value. And all I can do is like, really? Oh, thanks for telling me. You know, after selling, you know, I'm not bragging, but, you know, we sold 3 million books in 1 year. That was a physical product, you know. It's interesting.
Oh, I'm glad it's going that way, personally. I think physical products are just, they get consumed better than digital usually. And, you know, I mean, does it do someone any good if they download a PDF they never read, but they get something in the mail, it's physical, it's in their hands, they can
Agreed.
Take it around, it's portable.
Yeah. I
love
think,
it.
Though, that the prospecting, you know, I don't want to be sound like a Luddite, and I love email, and I think, as I always say, the internet thing, this internet thing will catch on. you know, but I think that prospecting intelligently online with digital content makes a whole lot of sense, you know, in terms of margins. But to ignore direct mail and physical product on the back end, I say ignore it at your peril. Because, you know, you have this opportunity to go multi-channel with something that still scales. I mean, direct mail still scales. I mean, you know, we still get 3%, 4%, 5% response rates in direct mail. And the lifetime value of a customer in direct mail is still much higher. So to ignore it completely seems crazy to me. I'm not sitting here saying everybody should be in direct mail, nor am I saying you should launch in direct mail. But I guess maybe I'll be the T-Rex dinosaur roaming the wild, wild west for quite a while, kind of preaching the fact that I don't care if online's your medium of choice for your first sale. Why don't you think about a bunch of other? I mean, think about TV, think about radio, think about print. You know, this is not... I bought a URL recently. I own this URL, I swear to God. Singlechannelmarketingissoboring.com. I own that.
Nice.
Yeah, if you go to it, I think you'll link to my site, to my personal site. But singlechannelmarketingissoboring.com is, to me, it's also not all that exciting to be in single-channel marketing. And, you know, just saying, what if Google decides to shut you down? You won't really like that channel anymore, will you?
Yeah, that's a big danger, being relying on one, like, online,
mm-hmm.
on the Internet at all. Just relying on the Internet is a big danger.
I totally agree.
You know, the postal, yeah, I mean, the stamps never changed technology, right?
No, I mean, you know, the postal inspector can shut you down, too. I mean, you know, some people deserve to be accused of mail fraud. But, yeah, it's a little different being shut down. The Postal Service is a monopoly, like Google almost is a monopoly. but there are some analogies there. But, yeah, I mean, you know, as I always say, the least crowded inbox is the one you grew up with, assuming you're over, what, 30 years old, 35 years old?
That, you know what, when we were talking about this, I wanted to ask you this. Since the Internet's becoming more and more popular, I guess, with marketers, have you noticed an increase in response in direct mail since the Internet's been out, or has it stayed the same or gone down? Or
no, it hasn't. Well, it certainly hasn't gone down. In some cases, it's gone up. In some cases, it's been kind of the same. But, of course, if we have a crappy control package, it'll go down because then the creative sucks, right? It's a different discussion.
Yeah.
Or if the list selection
yeah.
sucks, the response will go down. But pound for pound, direct mail still scales like it always did. The biggest difference in direct mail today is the availability of universes, of outside lists. Because so many people have abandoned direct mail, you're not going to get to as many outside lists. But I will tell you this, the sophistication with which you can do a direct mail campaign, you can actually weed out much more. There is such sophisticated bad debt files where I could sell with a bill me offer, like a soft offer where you don't have to put your credit card in, when you get a free book or a free subscription, a trial subscription, and I could do so many great screens that my response rate might be lower than it might have been 5 years ago. My pay up is going to be so much higher, and my lifetime value will be that much higher as well. So I'm going to rephrase your question. Are response rates higher? Maybe, maybe not. Depends on the creative, depends on the offer, all that all depends. But the sophistication with which you can do list segmentation in direct mail is as good as it's ever been, and the ability to bring in new customers that have the highest lifetime value is as good as it's ever been, if not better.
Nice, nice. And I know a lot of people who are, they'll test everything online where it's cheap, and then they'll take it offline after they have it working online. They tell me that it's just that much easier to make it work.
Yeah, and we've done a lot of online testing. I mean, you know, some of it, most of it translates. I mean, good copy is good copy, right? And, you know, the, I guess the proof was when we took our, you know, 32-page magalogs or tabloids and stuck them into an HTML format and put them online, and then when we tried to cut them and made them shorter online, they didn't do as well. So, you know, I'm sure you subscribe, knowing you, because I read you a lot, it's not about how long or short the copy is. It's about how effective it is.
You know, I'd love
boring,
to get my stuff shorter.
People aren't going to read it if it's boring.
I'm always trying to like find ways to make things shorter, but it never happens.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? You know, if you can write compelling copy, write to your heart's content.
Oh yeah, I just got into the golf niche recently. I'm partnering in a golf business, and I wrote the ad just to get it launched. And I mean, I wanted it to be like a page.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up being 12 pages.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's the way it goes. But
yeah.
I got to ask you about one of my personal marketing copywriting heroes. I've never met the guy, of course, and that's Gene Schwartz. Big, huge fan, and I know a lot of people on my list are a huge fan of his. And what are some, you actually knew the guy. What are some things you've learned just from working with him?
So Gene and I were pretty close, actually. Marty and Gene were very, very close. And Gene wrote the launch package for Boardroom Reports when Marty started his business. You know, read 300 business magazines in 30 minutes and get the guts of each. That was Gene Schwartz's headline, and he launched this business with Marty Edelson, not as a partner, but as a copywriter. And so, you know what I would do for your readers if you want? I wrote a blog post, which you probably have because I think I gave it to you. It was called It's Not About the Money. It's Not Always About the Money. And that was a big lesson I learned from Gene Schwartz. So one of the stories I love telling, and it's in this blog post in detail, but Gene, I learned from Gene, who was a very, very wealthy man. I mean, he was an art collector. He had a world-class modern art collection. In fact, he couldn't even fit all the art he had in his apartment on Park Avenue. So when I used to have monthly lunches with him, I would go to his apartment, and then if I went 2 months later, all the art had been changed. Like, it was almost like going to a museum exhibition. But the other thing you would notice in Gene Schwartz's apartment is that what wasn't covered up by paintings was covered up by bookshelves. And, you know, Gene Schwartz understood that copywriters are not, they don't happen by accident. They are people who are voracious readers who know a lot about a lot. And it's not that you have to be an expert on everything to be a writer about one thing. But if you are an expert on a lot of things and you are a voracious reader, you're going to be that much better a writer. And Gene totally understood that. So that's like a big, big, big lesson I learned from him. Another one that I learned from Gene is this going back to it's not just about the money, that you really have to start looking at how you build a business. And Gene, as a copywriter, understood how important lists were. He wasn't necessarily a list guy. I mean, he used to call me all the time for list advice, and I used to tell him all the lists that Boardroom was mailing so he could mail them for his little company, which was called Instant Improvement. And Instant Improvement, you know, mailed these like little, small books, and they were weird. I mean, he had some weird health books. He had The Tao of Sexology, and he had How to Rub Your Stomach Away. I mean, classic Gene Schwartz copy and books. And Gene understood that his little Instant Improvement, which was his love, I mean, even though he wrote copy for other people and all that, he understood that he needed to mail outside lists because he didn't have a big database. It's a small little publishing company. So Gene, in his infinite wisdom, became really close friends with, obviously he was already close friends with Marty Edelstein, and he was already close friends, and he became close friends with Pat Capora, who ran Rodale Books. So between Rodale and Boardroom, we were probably the two biggest mailers of health books in the 1980s. You know, Rodale, if people don't know who Rodale is, that's the publishers of Prevention Magazine and Men's Health Magazine, and they do a whole line of health books, which are just, you know, they're probably the largest health book publisher. I mean, I guess you might say there might be some people who've surpassed them since, but Rodale was the number one. So we used to get together at Marty's apartment on 72nd Street in New York, and it was Gene Schwartz, Pat Capora, me, Marty, and we would just sort of talk marketing for the evening, and Gene would talk about what products were coming up for us and which products he might want to write for both Rodale and us. And basically, Marty never paid Gene a penny for his copy, and Gene had controls galore for Boardroom. And what Gene would do is he would write a package for a book that we had, Healing Unlimited, and we would give him 750,000 names from our database that he could mail for instant improvement. And Gene understood that the idea that he'd be able to mail that many names, sell more books of his own, then he'd be able to market more books, which he really liked to do. It was something that he loved. So he was doing what he loved. And you know what? The money did follow, because if he was selling books, more books, because he had more lists to mail, therefore he made more money on the book sales, and then he was able to mail multiple times to that same list. And then his list got bigger, and then he was able to rent his list, and he made list rental income on that. So by not thinking about that I could charge Boardroom $20,000 or $30,000 for a package, he was looking long-term that he could make hundreds of thousands of dollars by getting 750,000 names for a package. And I just thought that was brilliant. And it told me that any copywriter who doesn't pay attention to lists and what their client is mailing on a regular basis is missing a huge boat. And I look at it as something, when I hire a new copywriter, if they're not asking me a lot of questions about the list universe we mail, the list universe that's worked and not worked, who we exchange with in our lists and all that. And then, of course, you want to know the demographics and the psychographics and all that. But it's such an important component that a lot of copywriters, I think, let that slip past them. And Dick Benson, who was another one of my mentors, who is a direct mail guru, always said mailers don't spend enough time on lists. Now, he did, before he died, gave me permission to say no one spends enough time on lists except Boardroom. So yeah. I came out of the list business. So, you know, when I met Dick for the first time, he actually was impressed that I was a list guy who was moving toward the circulation marketing side, which was rare. And so I became a good friend to Dick Benson in terms of recommending lists to him too, because he had the University of California Berkeley Wellness Letter and the Johns Hopkins Wellness Letter. So that was a big lesson from Gene, just about the whole list thing. And if you want that post, that blog for your, you know, list, I would give you a link to that. And then I think one other quick thing about Gene is that this concept that sometimes your best copy could be sitting on the editing room floor. And what I mean by that is that you give Gene a book and say, write a package, he would always think beyond the book. He would see what was in the book and be able to write fascinations from it, which was one of his real talents. But then he would think about what's not in the book, that could be in the book, that should be in the book. You know, he's reading, I'll use a loose example, but he's reading our health book and he sees, you know, three secrets about lowering blood pressure with certain fruits, for example. I use that example in my Bob Lycall. But then, you know, maybe he'll come back and say, can you go to your editors and see if there are any other blood pressure cures that are not medication, that aren't fruits, so then I can write a fascination that would be really fascinating that said, did you know that you not only can find blood pressure cures in your fruits, but also your shoes, I'm making that up, whatever the thing that the editors could find. And so Gene never let it rest, so that he always wanted to find stuff. And he would actually interview our editors and find out what they didn't put in the book or what they thought was too controversial. And I'll tell you, one of the writers we work with today, Paris Leonopoulos, who's a great writer and a very good friend, Paris is like he's a slave to this sort of thing. It's like he always wants to know what's not there that I might be missing out on. And he'll go to the editor of a newsletter or someone who wrote a book and say, what didn't you put in this book that you thought was too controversial or too edgy? Let's go take another look at it. I'm not saying we should take it if it's irresponsible, but if we can then take it to another doctor or somebody else to prove it out, maybe, just maybe, we'll be able to come up with a great edgy fascination and a great piece of content to put in the book or the newsletter. And I think copywriters need to think like that. Like, it's not just what you're handed by the client, but you're the creative guy or gal. You can start dictating. And you may not get there. You know, some publishers just aren't going to help you with that. But imagine if they do, and imagine if you come up with some great stuff. It could lead to some of the best headlines you'll ever write. And I think Gene would have said that some of the best stuff he ever wrote might not have been stuff that was in the original version of whatever he was writing about. So really important lesson that I learned from Gene. It's just that voraciousness, you know what I mean? He never let it rest. And Marty was like that, too. That's why they were such good friends. You know, they just never let it rest. And it was interesting about both of them, even though they both had strokes in their life, I never thought that they were, like, really stressed out about just never letting it rest, because some people get really stressed about that. You know, there's always, like, something they're not doing, so they're getting all uptight about it. I never got that from Gene or Marty, even though they both ended up having strokes in their life. But interesting. I just thought of that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. It sounds like, because I know a lot of people listening to this, at least the people on my list are listening to this or reading the transcript. A lot of them are not necessarily, I mean, there's a lot of freelancers, but there's also just a lot of entrepreneurs who want to get better at writing ads and all that. And if they're selling information, doing what Gene did, like, because I'm the same way, I just sell my own stuff. We have the power to go and create whatever fascinations we want because we control the content anyway.
That's correct. That's correct. In fact, I think Gene, very often, I remember, you know, our editors going nuts, adding stuff to a book late in the process because Gene came up with a great fascination that we could end up supporting with a new piece of content.
Yeah, it almost sounds like what they used to do in the old days where they'd write the ad first and then create a product around that.
Yeah, there's something to that, Ben. I think that, you know, I'm not a student of the Mad Men, but I think that, you know, I think there's something to what you just said. Absolutely. I think, sometimes it's, you know, we fall in love with our products and we think that it's just that. And, you know, what do our people really want? You know, and I think we talk about that a lot, but we don't necessarily do it when the rubber hits the road.
Now, Gene, the book that I haven't read all of Gene Schwartz's books, but the one I've read, like, I don't know, 14, 15 times, I'm going to go dip into it again actually soon, is Breakthrough Advertising. And, you know, like a lot of copywriters, we rave about that book, but it's hard to find. Are you guys selling that anymore? Because
well,
you used to sell it.
We own the rights to it, so I have copies of it. It's not on the Bottom Line website because the Bottom Line website is more of a consumer site that supports our newsletters. So Breakthrough Advertising is in a different category of the B2B side. I think I'm thinking maybe, you know, after the Titans event that I'm doing in September, I might create, you know, a site that puts the book up there. And we do sell it technically for $95. But I'll tell you that I've given away a lot of copies over the years because it became a labor of love to republish that book. The story behind it is interesting because after it went out of print, the original edition was written in 1966. Not a word was changed. Marty and I reprinted like 250 copies, I guess sometime in the early 80s, and we gave it away to the list community just as a gift. And then it went out, and then we just didn't think about it again. And then maybe 10 years later, it was after Gene had passed away, we saw a live bid on eBay. It was later than that because eBay wasn't around then, but maybe it was after 2000, that we saw a live bid on eBay for like $925 for an original edition of Breakthrough Advertising.
Huh.
And Marty and I looked at each other and said, "This is crazy. I mean, it's a forgotten classic." So we then went to Barbara Schwartz, Gene's widow, and we're friends with her still too. She's still a wonderful, one of the great art collectors in New York. And we said, "Let's do the book." And she said, "Absolutely. Continuing Gene's legacy will be great." So that's when we reprinted it. Didn't change a word. Marty wrote a new foreword for the book. That's the version we have now. It's a black cover. we technically sell it for $95, and we do sell some copies, but it's more of like something that we have. So it is available from me for $95. Maybe I've had other people, offer it to their list, and I don't really care about the money so much. I'd rather get the book out there. So, splitting 50-50 with somebody to sell the copies for us is fine. So I'm not making an affiliate deal on this call, but I certainly would do that because it's more about spreading Gene's wisdom than it is about being a moneymaker.
Well, I'm happy to spread the word about it, whether there's an affiliate commissioner. I don't really care about that either as much.
Yeah.
People just keep asking me. Like one of my friends, Dan Meredith, he actually asked one of the questions I'm going to ask you soon. He's kind of a newer copywriter, and he's like, man, where can I get it? And I'm like, huh, it used to be on this side. I don't know where it's at anymore.
He can get it from me. He can get it from me.
So now I want to kind of ask you something like more of your experiences here. I know you've seen a lot of split tests because you're the best in the world at picking the winner after you know the result.
The quote that I use sometimes is like, I can predict the result of any test once I have the results. Right?
Like, what are the two or three, or maybe just one, I don't know how many of these you have on the top of your head, of crazy test results? You were just like, I cannot believe that one.
There were a couple. It's funny. I will tell you that single variable testing, which is critical in direct mail especially, where you just test one thing and everything else in the package is the same, that's where I have seen, it's not crazy, but, changing just a couple of words on an order card, certainly changing the price is huge. I've not had the one that, the $29.97 versus the $29.99 type of test. I haven't seen, like, big shifts in response rates over my career. I've seen winners and losers, but not, like, big shifts. But I think that little things do mean a lot, especially on the order card. But as far as like straight copy, there's been certain copy that I read and I said, this is so crazy, written by a great writer. One that comes to mind is a package that Jim Rutz wrote, who was one of the great copywriters of all time, and he wrote a magalog for us, and it was all about this like fictitious couple called Limo Larry and Champagne Sherry, and how they and it's a classic package. I'm going to give away a PDF of it at my event as one of the classic boardroom packages. And I'll tell you, I'm sure that when we read that the first time, it was like, all right, you know what? I guess I'm going to trust Jim Rutz that he knew what he was doing with this. But Jim, some other copywriter told me recently, Jim was one of those writers that he was almost impossible to copy or to learn from because he had a really unique style. Like you could learn a lot by reading Gary Bensavenga copy. You can learn a lot by reading, Jim Punkry copy. You can learn a lot by reading Clayton Makepeace copy. I don't know that Jim Rutz copy, like, you'd want to try to imitate it because you'd probably screw it up. And so, so that was one, from a copy platform and the way that he structured it, it just seems sort of silly on the surface, live like this rich couple kind of thing. And it went through the roof. It was just incredible. It was just so entertaining and so insightful as far as what the customer that we were going after. And then I think I've had some crazy results over the years when I've tested what I'll call gimmicks versus deep copy. Those are the terms I'll use. By a gimmick, I'll say a package that looks like a survey that's not really a survey. We want your opinion. Send this in today with your opinion, and we'll start your subscription, whatever. Or one of those packages that we actually send a real – we don't do these anymore, and they're dangerous. But you send a real check in the mail, like a dollar check, and when they cash the check, that triggers the trial subscription. And you can do that legally. You have to be very – the disclosures have to be key. And when I see results like – and we've gotten packages like that way back to work. And then you start testing those against like a 64-page bookalog that spends so much time selling the product, selling the message. The copy is so expertly crafted, whether it's a Gary Bensavenga or, a Mel Martin or whatever. And seeing the results of, in both cases, sometimes the purely gimmicky, transactional type package wins, and sometimes the long copy, you know, get into the under the surface, read 64 pages on your nightstand, wins. And then winning and losing, the actual analysis is so interesting, because usually the gimmick or the transactional is going to be a very high front end response, because it's a bill me offer. So you're going to get a lot of people saying yes, 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 5, 6, 7% sometimes. But the amount of people that will actually convert or pay for the subscription or the book could be 20, 30, or 40%, or 20 or 30%, and maybe even less. And then when you do the 64-page bookalog, your front-end response might be 2.5% or 2% instead of 5 or 6, but your pay-up could be 55%, because you're basically getting somebody who's wedding themselves. Not wedding with a T, wedding with a D. They're wedding. They might be wedding themselves too, because they're so excited. But they become, you know, much more familiar with the product. What they get is not a surprise, obviously, because you just sold them for 64 pages or 52 pages or whatever. And what you find with those people too is that they stick around longer. Your renewal rates are higher on those people. So it's really important to track the results of those kinds of packages against each other into year 2 and 3. What's the lifetime value of a new person coming in from a transactional package versus a deep package? What did I call it? Gimmick versus deep, or transactional versus heavy copy? But you got the message of those are extremes. And so when I say I wouldn't say crazy results, but you can see that the analysis is just not so simple. You know, it's not just this one got a 6% response, this one got a 3% response, 6% wins. No. Now you have to look at pay up in our case. 6% got a 20% pay up. 3% got a 50% pay up. Okay, another piece of data. And now a year later, the people from the 3% front end and 50% pay up renewed at 35%, whereas the people who came up at 6% and 20% pay up renewed at 8%. Now you've got a 2-year analysis that says this isn't even close, and that you got to be in the deeper, you know, bookalog package. And I'm not quoting exact numbers, of course, but I think you get the idea.
Right.
So that's where testing comes to science. And it's funny, as I'm saying all this, I'm thinking about my friends from high school and college who knew that I never took a math course after like 10th grade, because I hated math, and I'm not good at math to this day. But when I say I'm a slave to my numbers, or as Dick Benson used to say, you have to believe your numbers. That's what direct marketing is all about. I am a slave to my numbers. Someone else is doing them for me. If you think I'm doing the spreadsheet, you're nuts, because it's going to be because I don't know how to do it. I suck at it. But give me the numbers. I'll tell you what the winner is, because I'm going to analyze it up and down. And I guess I'm sort of proud of myself for actually not being resistant to that, because, you know, being an English major, I was like, you know, oh, I don't want to do math. Screw that. But there's a lot of math in direct marketing.
There's actually sounds like there's a lot of creativity in that, too, to look that far into the future and try to strategize all these different offers and what worked for, you know, who's renewing 2 years later. And
yeah.
I don't know anybody who goes that deep. I mean, that's really
interesting. I think you have to.
I guess that's why you guys...
Yeah, I think in subscription marketing you have to. Otherwise, I think you're really missing the boat. Unless you have an advertiser, you know, if you're a magazine, you need advertisers, so you'll pay ridiculous amounts of money to get people on your list. But that was we didn't have advertising. We couldn't afford to do that. You know, we had a thing with Canada. We did a mailing into Canada once, and Canadian response rates are like double what the U.S. were back in the 1980s, and we got like double the response rate. But we got like a third of the renewal rate, because we'd given the same newsletter. So Bottom Line Personal talking about U.S. banks, can you imagine someone sitting in Toronto thinking that this is useful?
Yeah.
You know, and we didn't think about that until we saw the 11% renewal rate instead of a 33% renewal rate. So we got burned without looking at year two. So there's an example of, you know, we're not perfect by any means. I mean, we make a lot of mistakes. But then that one we didn't make a second time.
Yeah, this is a little off topic, but you just got me thinking about something. We were talking about selling physical products through the mail and all that, using physical mail to send your ads and all that. And what I have a, you know, I print in, I swear I have a print newsletter that I sell. And what I love about it, and I assume you guys probably love this about it, is that people are paying you to send them advertisements if something's stuck in the envelope with it.
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, I think that because our Bottom Line Personal and Bottom Line Health newsletters mail flat, you know, they mail as self-mailers. We didn't have the opportunity for advertising, but we did have one of our other newsletters, which we don't have anymore, which was our Natural Healing newsletter, mailed in an envelope. And the ability to put inserts in there advertising other products of ours and also third party gave an opportunity even in the newsletter business to not do on-page advertising but at least to do some advertising that was related to the original product. It wasn't as big a deal for us because we were just not interested in the advertising revenue. It just wasn't part of our DNA. But there was a guy back in the 80s named Mac Ross who passed away, who I always give credit for really discovering the newsletter business advertising. You know, I think he was the first one that really turned that whole business on its ear in terms of Philips putting advertisements in their health newsletters in the envelope. I remember they used to sell ionizers and then they got into the supplement business later on, and that was huge. I mean, without mailing in an envelope and advertising for supplements, by the way, it just happened a couple of weeks ago, Philips Publishing, which became Healthy Directions, just sold for $195 million 2 weeks ago.
Wow.
And that's not because it was a newsletter business. It's because it was a supplement business. And that supplement business started as ads, as inserts in the envelopes. I mean, you can check that, but I think anybody from the Philips Publishing crew back in the 80s, and I followed what they did, I believe they would source the advertising with the newsletter to being able to get into the supplement business initially.
Well, that's interesting. It's kind of like an accidental thing for them.
I guess. I don't know what the what was happening behind closed doors at Philips at the time. I know Mac Ross was a great marketer, and I'm sure he sold that to the hilt, to management. You know, let's get some ads in this thing. We're mailing in an envelope anyway, and it's mailing. There's room in this envelope.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I subscribe to that one newsletter, Dr. William Campbell, or what's his name, Dr.
Campbell, I think, might be Agora, but you might be thinking of either Julian Whitaker or, Stephen Sinatra, Williams, David Williams. They have a bunch of Phillips' newsletters are pretty well known. But it's the same principle, whether it's Agora, whether it's Phillips, the old Phillips, whether it's Soundview, they all have doctors with supplement lines that they sell as ads with the newsletters.
I'm going to switch over to some of these subscriber questions. I promised them I would do this. Much as I'd like to just hog all your time. My friend Gabor Wolf asks, Brian, what's your preference about graphic designers, copywriters, website coders? Do you have them in-house on the payroll, or do you outsource these jobs?
You know, interesting. I think they're all a little different, the ones that he listed here. I mean, we have people who do graphic design in-house, and we do have website coders in-house. I think the website coding, once you get big, could probably be completely in-house, because I think you'll get it done faster. Although I'm a big proponent of anything you can do better on the outside, do it on the outside. On the designer side, I think your graphic designers in-house should be there for sort of the basic housekeeping stuff and the basic stuff, and then you give them jobs that if they want to spread their wings a little bit. But if you're doing full-blown direct mail, like Magalogs, Bookalogs, advanced HTML, I'm thinking that graphic designers, the best graphic designers are not looking for a full-time job in a company. They're going to be freelance because they can make more money that way. And you can see that I've avoided copywriters completely so far in this conversation because I'm of the belief, except that Agora proved me wrong because they developed an in-house copywriting school and got them trained under Bill Bonner and Mark Ford, that I think it's incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to create copywriters internally that are going to rival the copywriters that can demand the big money in royalties on the outside. Because by the time they get to the outside demanding those royalties, they are so, I'll say, taxi-tested tough that they know that no one can pay them more than they can make as a freelancer. I learned this lesson at a very young age when we tried to once do a mailing package through an agency. And I don't want to like put down all the agencies in the world, but it, you know, Gary Bensavenga worked at Ogilvy & Mather, I think, until he realized he didn't need to work at Ogilvy & Mather anymore because he could make, you know, 10 times or 100 times more freelancing because he was that good. To work on a straight salary would have been crazy. So anybody who's a copywriter at that level, it's going to be hard. I mean, I once tried to take one of my copywriters, one of my A-plus copywriters, and say, would you work for us full-time in-house? And literally, I would have had to probably pay him well over $1 million to hire them as a quote-unquote employee. And as a PS to this whole thing, and I've told this story before, that Marty had a philosophy that it didn't matter sometimes. There were years where our copywriters, outside copywriters, were our highest paid employees. If you counted them as employees, I put employees in quotation marks. So if they were an employee, if they were equivalent to an employee, they would have been making double what the highest paid employee was making. They're not getting the benefits, of course, of being a full-time employee, but in terms of straight dollars in the bank, in their bank account, they were making double what the highest paid employee was making. And you know what Marty's attitude on that was? You know, some people would say, how could you pay them that much? You have to renegotiate that. It's too much to pay them. And Marty would just look at them with a wry smile and say, well, if they're making that much, how much do you think I'm making?
Yeah.
And what he said was, and if I don't pay them that, I have to go to a copywriter who's not going to beat them. And then I've got an inferior piece of creative that's not going to make me as much money. And net-net, I'd rather pay the A-plus writer that much and have a bigger business than pay the B writer and have a smaller business that's not going to grow.
There was way back in the day, Gary Halbert wrote a newsletter about how all the, and this is at, I guess in the 80s, like all the best writers work for Phillips. And no, the only, they make the copywriters get paid more than anyone else at Phillips except for Mr. Phillips. Like,
I
he
know.
Was the only one who made more than the copywriter.
I this is a true statement. And Marty was not, Marty didn't take a huge salary. I know for a fact, because I saw the numbers. There were years where there was a copywriter in a particular year who made more money than Marty.
And that's a A++ copywriter, I take it.
It was.
Well, speaking of the A-plus copywriters, next question. Wayne Brown at businessbuildingtechnician.com asks, who are the top three copywriters currently, and who do you think are the all-time greats?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think there are people who are all-time greats who never really wrote for Boardroom, and yet I think they're all-time greats. I mean, that would be, you know, a John Carlton, for example, who's just one of the all-time great copywriters and teachers of copywriting. And so he's a perfect example of someone who's really never had a control for Boardroom, and yet I consider him one of the greats of all time. But I always think in terms of Mount Rushmore. So you asked for three. I'm going to give you four.
Okay.
So I've got the Mount Rushmore of pre-1995 and then the post-1995. So I have two Mount Rushmores. So the Mount Rushmore in our early days, I always used to say were, for Boardroom, were Gene Schwartz, Mel Martin, Gary Bensavenga, and Jim Rutz. They had the most controls. They were the hardest workers. They studied everything. They did everything right. So that makes them the best Boardroom writers. The current Mount Rushmore is actually speaking at my event, and I'm calling them just that, the Mount Rushmore since 1995, who have been responsible for over 620 million pieces of direct mail since 1995 between the four of them. And that would be Paris Lampropoulos, David Deutsch, Eric Betchell, and Arthur Johnson. Are they the best writers? Now, let me just get a couple of big honorable mentions. I mean, Clayton Makepeace had a bunch of controls for us. Not as many as those four. Couldn't put him on the Boardroom Mount Rushmore, but he's on a lot of people's Mount Rushmore. Richard Armstrong's had a bunch of controls for us. Can I put him on Boardroom's Mount Rushmore? I can, but he's an amazing writer. Jim Punkry. Jim Punkrey, you know, had some of the was probably the number one health writer in the heyday of Rodale Press, and he was an in-house copywriter. He's had a couple of controls for us and some big ones, not as big as those other ones. So I, you know, I wasn't going to just, and I'm probably now didn't mention somebody that I'm going to kick myself later on that I didn't, because then I'm going to hurt their feelings and that's going to make me feel bad. But I've worked with all of them, and you know, there are many more. And it isn't Gary Bensavenga, you know, while he's not writing for other people right now, he does have this olive oil business. And if you look at what he's doing with that, writing for himself, he hasn't lost his touch, believe me. And I would say that if I had to pick the best living copywriter today, it's probably Gary Bensavenga. And I think that my Mount Rushmore, all four of them, would probably agree. So that's a good sign. And I think Clayton would agree. I think Carlton would agree. You know, Halbert is another one, like Carlton. I mean, Halbert's up there, but he never had a control for Boardroom. Didn't know Gary Halbert that well, so I, you know, can't speak to it as much. But some of the stuff he wrote was just pure genius. Another guy was Bill Jamie, more in the magazine world, and he did write some controls for us. And not as well known in the newsletter business, but in the magazine business, Bill Jamie was God. Bill Jamie was, I have a blog about him too. He was an interesting guy and a great copywriter. So I'm
can
betting.
Can you give us your blog? I want to read it.
Yeah. So I do a weekly, I do a weekly email. I guess it's a blog. I don't know what the definition of a blog is, but
either way, it's cool.
Yeah. It's a weekly email. And if you sign up, it's briankurtz.me, www.briankurtz.me. And the squeeze right now is an interview that, I did with Joe Polish with Marty about building Boardroom. And if you opt into that, then you'll be on my list and then you get a weekly email. And then, you know, my plan is to take all my blogs of the last year and put them into a book pretty soon, actually. So I'll have an ebook pretty soon, which will be free as well. So if you're on my, on my list, you'll eventually get all my past blogs as well. And, I have a title for that, too. It's How Life Imitates Direct Marketing.
Oh, I just signed up for it, so I've been wanting to ever since you mentioned it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, I know everybody listening to this is going to want to. So, okay, the next question is from Yasin Shar at yasinshar.com. And he asks, how do you bridge your offline marketing efforts with your online marketing at Boardroom?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of ways we do it. It's not just a simple bridge. I mean, it's kind of like it's a lot of different, I don't know, tributaries. I'm trying to think of a good analogy here. So one thing, of course, is that, you know, every time we get a control in direct mail, we create an HTML version, what we call an e-magalog, and that becomes the online version of that promotion. That's one way. Another way is we obviously have e-newsletters that sell our offline products, you know, in the e-newsletters. So there's a lot of cross-pollination sales-wise. I think that there's a lot of traffic building online for people to come to our site and then interest them in a digital version of one of our newsletters, and then once they're on the digital subscription file to see if they also want the print version. So there's a lot of that going on. There's clearly, you know, you can sign up for the digital and the print version of our newsletters at the same time. So other online, offline. I know I'm missing stuff. But it's not like... It's not church and state, but it's not. There are still some things that we can do in each of the channels that don't involve the other. Oh, another one would be, you know, basically with all the any email addresses we have of the people that we're mailing offline in direct mail, we can send them a pre-email to say, keep an eye out on your mailbox. So like the old Publishers Clearinghouse thing. Keep your eye in your mailbox because there's a piece coming for such and such product. Then they get the piece in the direct mail, and then we send them a post email. So pre and post